Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 479th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta.
And you know what, Mike? We just have not done enough stuff on cannabinoids.
No, if there's a void in the things we've covered, oh, that is a huge void. Yeah.
Except for the other 10 podcasts we've already done, but we're doing this. So this is a sole podcast on cannabinoids for a specific thing.
Right. So little background here. We've got a chronic pain guideline in the books. And for those of you who haven't noticed, James, I, and many others on the peer team, tons of them, in fact, have been working on systematic reviews of chronic pain. First osteoarthritis, then low back pain, then neuropathic pain. And this was all building to a chronic pain guideline for primary care, which is well underway now. And we're completing what we call the adjunct questions or the additional questions which came from the committee. In this case, were one of them was, you know, cannabinoids weren't included much in the three systematic reviews. And the reason they weren't included much is because it was covered in 2018 in our guideline.
Right.
But they wanted to know, has anything changed? That's reasonable. It's been 3 years and there's been lots and lots of talk that cannabinoids, because of the use going up with recreational and medical, we probably worked on the actual work for the last guideline was probably 2017. So it's been like 4 years. There must be so much more research in this area. And James, I know you're excited because you know how fast impactful research changes.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. And also, you know, if you sort of stand back and look at the landscape, really, the role for cannabinoids outside of, you know, getting stoned is for chronic pain. I mean,
is mostly for chronic pain. And in fact, yeah, most people who use cannabinoids for medical reasons are
using it for
anywhere from 60 kind of to 80% of them are using them for pain.
Yeah.
Some are for sleep, some are for mood and depression and those kind of things. Very rarely nausea and vomiting related to chemotherapy or spasticity.
Yeah, exactly. And in defense of the use of it, I mean, chronic pain is by definition not a good thing. Exactly. And if you've been, you know, going down the path of trying everything, every other drug and or non-drug treatment, it would not surprise me that the avenue leads to this for a lot of people, primarily for the lack of effect that we have a variety of things. And also the hype of it being, sort of natural and being around for, you know, we've used it for years, blah, 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 and all those sorts of things. So
all of the marketing themes that go behind natural therapies, right?
Yeah.
That it's natural, it's safe.
Yeah. So
one of those things that catch on so strongly.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's and I can't tell you if I meet anyone who says, you know what, I've tried everything and this is the only thing that works for me.
Yeah. If we have an effective therapy, it's another, because chronic pain can be so challenging and everyone has different results from different therapies and interventions. It's good to have a backup for people.
But again, it's still a value to look at the evidence.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about where we were. So as you know, we did, there are a ton of systematic reviews on this, an absolute ton. And what we decided to do for this adjunct question, they're kind of abbreviated systematic reviews, almost like tools for practice, but we're more detailed in describing the actual process. So one of our team members, Danielle, completed an in-depth search for this with the limits of looking at systematic reviews and focus kind of on the last 10 years. And so we reviewed a lot of articles, 113 of them, and they did the process of excluding. And this was the review of it was done by Anthony Train and I. Anthony's one of the faculty out in Queens, and he's a member of PEER. And so we ended up in the end with, after all the inclusion, exclusion, with 13 systematic reviews. And then what we did is we looked, we did a search ourselves just to make sure nothing was missing, and we found one more. And then I looked through my library of articles and I found one more. So in the end, we had 15 systematic reviews. What we found, though, quickly was that there wasn't many on, when we're thinking about chronic pain, we're thinking specifically this guideline, and that is osteoarthritis, low back pain, and neuropathic pain. And there weren't a ton on osteoarthritis or low back pain. So we did a specific RCT search for those. And we searched forward from the last systematic review that included osteoarthritis and back pain. And again, we didn't find any new RCTs. So the sad summative story is that OA and back pain have one RCT each.
Right.
But let's get into neuropathic pain, because that's where the majority of the research is. And one of the challenges for us is that when we think about neuropathic pain, we're thinking about the common things that we see. Not that neuropathic pain is nearly as common as OA, but when it happens, you're seeing it in diabetic neuropathy, post-herpetic neuralgia, that kind of thing. And so that would be what we would love to see the majority of the research on for primary care. But unfortunately, it's all sorts of chemotherapy-induced neuropathic pain, HIV neuropathic pain, brachial plexus tear neuropathic pain. So a bunch of things that are not nearly as common, but probably percolate up to get research because they're hard to treat.
No, exactly.
And so take that with a grain of salt when we're talking here about neuropathic pain, because it might not be the average patient in front of you. And I think that's just worthy of note. So we always, as James, as you know, we kind of focus on a 30% pain reduction as this kind of what's likely clinically meaningful for patients.
Yeah, yeah. And then also talk about how many people get to that threshold.
Yeah, because it allows us to have that conversation, not dissimilar to how many people benefit from statin therapy, how many people who are having an active problem like depression or whatever benefit from therapy versus placebo and that kind of thing. So this is exactly the same. It's a scale change, but how many people get to something meaningful. So if you're looking at how many people get there, on average, in the cannabinoid studies, about 30% of people feel better on placebo. And cannabinoids add another 9 to 10% to that. So 39% or so to 40%. So that's how many are actually feeling better. And I think that in and of itself is a helpful number. So it's a reminder that about 40% at best are going to feel better, and that means that 60% won't get to meaningful improvement in their pain with cannabinoids. And that may be frustrating to hear for those who are strong believers in the medicine, but that's what the research consistently shows.
And it also shows that if someone tells you they've had a response, 75% of the time it had nothing to do with the drug, because because you've got 40% responding with the treatment and 30% on placebo. That, you know, 30% is 75% of 40%, and so that's the nuance.
Exactly what you're hitting at.
Yeah,
the NNT there is not good. It's 11 or 10.
Yeah,
and many people will kind of, you know, when they see that, they will not be impressed for the treatment of an active condition to have an NNT. At 10 or above is often considered not as good, but that is what it is. There's talk that certain types are better, like inhaled, for example. There was a systematic review that focused on inhaled therapies and found a bigger difference. And many people go, aha, there's your reason to smoke cannabis or use an electronic cigarette type device or whatever. But the fact of this is, it's not actually as good, because the reason that it seems better is because the inhaled studies were all small and short term. And in our systematic review from 2018, and we looked at this very question, and we found that inhaled versus non-inhaled, so things like a subungual or a spray in the mouth is not like the Bixamols. is not, the inhaled is not better, is because the inhaled studies were all small and short, and that was what was statistically different.
Yeah. And if they are better, they're, instead of having a numbers needed to treat of 10, it might be downwards of 7 or 6, you know, if with all the caveats of the research that you just mentioned. So it's still not, you know, occurring. It's not a huge benefit, but it's important to remember that 1 in 10 is not an unusual number for neuropathic pain for anything.
Oh, I know. Yeah, you're totally right. Like in neuropathic pain, if you rank them in a non-direct comparison way, because we don't have good direct comparisons, the cannabinoids end up falling towards the bottom for sure. Yeah. But many people think that we didn't recommend them strongly because we're against cannabinoids or because people can get high on it or what have you. But the truth is that they're just not as effective. And they're riddled with biases. As we mentioned, we did subgroup analysis studies and found that short studies are better, have better results. Smaller studies have better results. Yeah. And James, you know, as well as I do, many of these studies are hours long.
Yeah. It's the acute treatment of chronic pain.
Absolutely. It's a single intervention to see how chronic pain is treated in them. And research has shown that the longer you follow people, the effect dwindles over time. Yeah, yeah. We've found that in our systematic reviews. But the next question is pain scales and how well does cannabinoids reduce pain scales? And the research often isn't easily teased out. It's mainly what it shows is standard mean differences, which are pretty much useless.
They're not useless from a research perspective. They're useless from trying to figure out what it means.
Yeah, they're useless from as a clinician, right? They're useless as a researcher. You can say, this drug seems to work somehow. Yeah. I don't know how much.
No. Yeah, exactly.
Or how well, but it might be working. Mm-hmm. That's your.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's all you can say.
That's the bottom line conclusion from a standard mean difference result. So yeah, I'm not a big fan, as you can tell.
No.
But the weighted mean difference, most of those studies will tell you what the difference is between placebo and the intervention. In the case of cannabinoids, it's somewhere around 0.7. They're about 0.7, 0.6 better. And so the cannabinoids are better than placebo. But it doesn't tell you where you start. It doesn't tell you how far placebo gets you. So if you were to look at one study where I could tease out some numbers, and it's not perfect because when you meta-analyze things, you're weighting different studies differently. But when you extract data from this level and just try and calculate averages, you're not getting the same weighting. So take these numbers with a grain of salt, but they are probably better than anything else we have at the present time. So you start in most neuropathic pain studies at around a 6.6 pain scale out of 10. And that is a little bit higher than what you would see with most back pain in most OA. They're around 6. These are just a tiny bit higher. And with the intervention of placebo, you drop from 6.6 down to about 5.4. And then the intervention itself will get you down to somewhere around 4.7 or 4.8. When you're taking cannabinoids. So that allows a kind of comparison in your mind. If you're a scales person, you go from 6.5 down to about 5.5 down to about just under 5 or 4 and a bit. So they are working. Now, if I'm a person who wants to find and my conclusion wants to be cannabinoids don't work, what I would tell you now is 0.65 to 0.74 is not a clinically meaningful difference in a pain scale, and therefore cannabinoids don't work.
Right. And that's what's done for many things. Alzheimer's medications and sometimes with depression, but many medications like this.
Yeah, they do that. And that, I think you would argue too, is the wrong way to look at things, because the placebo group got a meaningful difference. It went from 6.6 to 5.4, so it was greater than 1. Mm-hmm. So, and then the drug itself went to somewhere around 4.8. So it got a meaningful difference over 6.6, the separation between the two didn't reach this this pretty much arbitrary meaningful cutoff. So that's why you need that how many got 30% to also distinguish for clinicians and their patients to separate all this out. So this is actually very detailed information. It's really all you need other than the adverse events.
Right.
But it tells you that the intervention is working. It's haunted with all sorts of problems, big and small studies. They enrolled cannabis users often for these. There's no blinding in these studies. Everyone knows when they're getting cannabinoids. And more than that, the people who are studying them, even in a blinded study, can figure out who actually got the cannabinoid.
Yeah.
And it doesn't even matter if it's a smoked cannabinoid or a the actual cannabis. It can also be drugs like dronabinol and nabilone and that kind of thing. Nurses who were in these studies can sort out the patients who got...
Now, not all of them, but they have a very good idea about it because of the side effect profile.
Yeah. It in some studies, approaches 80 to 90% are sorted out.
Yeah.
So it really is a non-blinded. None of these are really blinded. The attempt is made, and that's admirable, but you really have to acknowledge that blinding is severely limited in these, for whatever that's worth. James, we've talked about that lots. So, the improvement over time seems to be similar in the scale changes, which is good. It's just probably placebo works less. And there was a specific one that looked at diabetic neuropathy, but it only included one study. So I'm somewhat hesitant to say the nabiximol did not fare well in this small study of 30 patients. Compared to other treatments of neuropathic pain, but it was very small in a single study. So that's it for, you know, kind of neuropathic type pain, James.
Yeah, no, and it's not, like I said, it's not dissimilar to what we said a while ago, but it's just giving you some more nuances. And it's important, even if there's, I think it's nice that you can know that there isn't a lot of new stuff. Now, in defense of that, it's not easy to do these studies, and it takes a while and get ethics and you know, we've only had it where it's where the legal aspect has been removed or made it easier to do these studies. So these are not easy studies to do anyway.
The blinding and stuff. But I will say, James, like there was when the talk of legalization for both medical and then recreational, we heard from the producers that there were going to be so much research if they just allowed to.
Yeah, and
we certainly didn't see that turnaround.
Yeah, and anybody who believed that would be like, I've got a bridge, I will sell them, because it's, you know, that's just it's the typical comment that every company makes, and it is possible they actually meant it,
it's possible they believed it themselves.
Yeah.
It is possible. I will not disagree there. But it was a wonderful piece of folklore.
Yeah.
Let's talk really briefly, because we spent a lot of time on neuropathy. Yeah. Let's talk really briefly about chronic pain for the back. So this was one crossover study that was 4-week treatment durations in a crossover. That means that if you got placebo this 4-week period, you'd get intervention after a brief break period. We call them washouts. Mm-hmm. You'd go on to the other one. This, again, was a small trial, 30 patients given nabilone. So again, remember, many of these studies are not actually inhaled cannabis, smoked cannabis. It's usually pharmaceutical-derived cannabinoids. This one is nabilone, 0.25 to 1 milligram a day. It was done in Germany, so we did some translating of the German with Google Translate, plus we used a German author had done a systematic review that included this and included a ton of the data from the study, so we also use them because theirs was published in English.
I mean, it's really, you just have to be a sleuth with all these things. I mean, there's you know, now you're getting into the language nuances and good grief.
Yeah. And you have to find it. So this was published in a journal called Schmertz. And the guy Fitzcharles publishes these, and that team is, they publish in German and in English. And so I went for him because I thought if anyone's going to be able to read this article better than Google Translate. And they looked at pain scales, and what they found was that pain over the weeks, the 4-week period, was 0.9 reduction with Navalone and 0.5 with placebo, and that didn't reach statistical significance.
And that's, again, on a 10-point scale.
Yeah, on a 10-point scale, yeah. 0 to 10. And so the current pain was 0.6 versus 0, and that did reach statistical significance. Mm-hmm. And then quality of life, and they used some headache outcomes, et cetera. None of those were statistically significant. I think that the challenge here is it's a tiny study mm-hmm. that found 1 out of 5 positive outcomes. And there was no responder data here. There's a, mm-hmm. there's a bunch of things missing. So I don't think that we could hang our hat on this for chronic back pain.
Well, in either way, whether it works or not, yeah, doesn't work.
To say it doesn't work or to say it works.
Yeah, exactly.
I think the take-home message is we just don't know.
Yeah.
And let's talk briefly about osteoarthritis. This was knee osteoarthritis. It's another crossover study, and this time it had 2-week treatment periods. This was one of the challenges for the peer group is when you're looking for high-level stuff, what you want is if they did a crossover, tell us about the first round of the crossover individually. And we couldn't get that, and that's why a lot of these kinds of studies were excluded when peer did their systematic reviews. Mm-hmm. So 38 patients were given a drug that wasn't even a cannabinoid for sure. It's PF0445784545. James, you've used this.
Oh, that's very well known. Yes. Yeah.
You've written that on a script.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I personally take it. But I don't take the 845. I take the 844.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, that makes all the difference.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's, yeah. Anyway,
you can't see it, but right now, audience, we're holding up the chemical structure of 4, 4, 5, 7, 8, 4, 5
to show you how clear why it clearly works. Yeah.
And now James is holding up some cellular membrane pictures and showing it.
Yeah.
So it was compared to placebo and to naprosyn at 500 milligrams BID. You might be slightly more familiar with that medicine. Mm-hmm. Why did this get included? It's listed to have endocannabinoid properties. And so this just shows how desperate we were.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, you're really dredging the research.
We're dredging. And it's I know this will seal the deal for you, James. It's a potent and selective FAAH1 inhibitor.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't need to tell me that.
You knew that.
Oh, yeah.
So WOMAC pain scale, there was no difference. WOMAC pain and function scale, there was no difference. Mm-hmm. But they did note that naprosyn was consistently better than placebo, but this intervention wasn't. So again, this research says it doesn't work, but I don't even know that this truly is a cannabinoid.
Yeah.
And even if it was, 38 patients in a crossover for 2 weeks is not enough to convince me.
Yeah. I mean, if 38 patients is enough for something that's really, really effective.
Yeah. If this worked like dynamite.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
If this was a PPI, you could probably show that with a PPI.
Yeah, exactly. You don't mean PPIs for osteoarthritis.
Yeah, PPIs.
PPIs. Well, you'd never know.
Dyspepsia. Well, you never know. So those are the two. So really we're pretty significantly lacking.
Yeah. Yeah.
Total withdrawal rates, total adverse events was just what we found before. It was about 80% in the cannabinoid group versus about 60% in the placebo group. And that's those total events. Remember, 60% of people are reporting some level of adverse events. So that's important to remember too. How many withdraw? It's somewhere around 10% in cannabinoids versus about 5% in placebo. The adverse events are all that you know very well: dizziness, nausea, cognitive disturbance, drowsy, and many of them are lower than 10, number needed to harms. So these events are common. Euphoria is just as common as dysphoria, mm-hmm. or if you want to reverse that, dysphoria is just as common as euphoria.
Yeah. And it's all in the eye of the beholder.
Absolutely.
You know, whether it's a good phoria or a bad phoria.
Yeah. Because some people don't like that sensation of, like some people actually enjoy, some people enjoy the kind of relaxation thing and some people feel a loss of control.
Exactly.
Or they have bad effects from cannabinoids that some people you know, obviously they have various effects. I'm not telling this to anyone, you know, anyone listening now isn't surprised by that. But, you know, we've all seen patients who have paranoia and hallucinations on them, and mm-hmm. they get adverse events like the not nearly captured in randomized control trials, but the chronic vomiting syndromes and that kind of thing. Yeah. So there's all sorts of the sedation's too strong, you name it.
Yeah. And the, some of the more severe sort of where you get a bit of dissociations and things like that is like, we're talking 1-3% of mm-hmm. people.
But it's still uncomfortable for them.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
The euphoria and dysphorias are generally around kind of 13-15%.
Yeah.
And a few of them occur also in the placebo, but it's only 1-3%. Okay, let's talk about – one of the things we should talk about is, but why do we hear that cannabinoids are so darn right effective? So part of it is the way the studies are done. They're not – the ones you're hearing about almost certainly aren't RCTs. So if I do a study where I'm surveying patients who were initiated on medical cannabinoids and continue to use them for a year – if I then survey them to say, do you think this is working? Well, I've selected patients mm-hmm. By choosing the ones that are still taking the therapy a year later.
Yeah, and you could be selecting the 1 in 10
result if you studied gabapentin.
Yeah, and you could be selecting the 1 in 10 that benefited.
Yeah, because you've already screened them out. All of the ones.
Yeah, so that's one,
aren't using them a year later.
Yeah.
So when you survey this group and find out that 70-80% of them say cannabinoids work well for their pain, of course they do, because they're the ones that, you know, you might, you know, I'm reaching way back here, but you could probably find a couple hundred people who liked New Coke. Mm-hmm. And that New Coke people, if you surveyed them 6 months later, and they were continuing to drink New Coke, they would tell you New Coke is great. It's the exact same thing.
That's the type of research. And it's also the people who have tolerated it. So it's such a select group. And so that's why, in my opinion, it's interesting research, but you should basically ignore it.
Yeah. The facts, well, interesting, are irrelevant.
Exactly.
And then there's all sorts of other little nuanced regions of how, or reasons, like which studies you include and how you include them, and then what statistics you do. One of these did an odds ratio, for example. So they changed the, if you rerun the statistics as a relative risk, it drops from a 46% improvement to a 30% improvement. Yeah. And that 30% is exactly what everyone else is finding. But the 46 could easily be sold as cannabinoids reduce pain meaningfully for almost 50% more people.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of a way to twist the numbers. So there's lots of reasons. We've only given you a sample of a few. But when you look at the evidence as we've reviewed for you, things are pretty much exactly the same as they were. We've got a massive gap in knowing if it works for back pain or OA pain. Mm-hmm. But for neuropathic pain of this, you know, combination of very broad different pain syndromes, if you mush them all together, about 39% will get better on cannabinoids and about 30% will get better on placebo.
And if you really want to, feel free to round that to 40 and 30%.
Yeah. And you can, and pain will go from about 6.6 down to 5.4 with placebo and 4.8 with cannabinoids.
Yeah.
That's the summary of all the data combined for neuropathic pain.
Everything that's new.
Combining everything that's new, So we've talked before about the differences in CBD and THC. I don't think we need to go over that today, James.
No, I agree.
That a lot. But if you're looking at the kind of summative evidence, nothing has changed. And I don't expect you can correct me, James, if you think differently. No. I don't expect really much to change in this area in the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
And maybe never.
And there's numerous reasons for that. I mean, you know, if you've got people using stuff and you've got a good market, the last thing you really want to do is research.
Yeah, because it can only hurt you.
Yeah, because you're not going to see a huge benefit because you know it doesn't work very well anyway. And so, mm-hmm. you know, yeah, so so we just thought we're bringing up all the new stuff, talking about some of the old issues around it and the problems, not just with cannabinoids, but research in general is very tricky. as we've tried to point out over 479 episodes of the podcast.
Yeah, and the research is being added slowly, but there's such a large base of, and there's small, short studies, etc. But it would take something massive to really shift in a big way what we've already seen in the research. And we included in this one's systematic reviews up to late 2020.
Yeah. So, and again, if you all you have to do is look at it. If all of a sudden a trial of 1,000 people come out showing that it works for neuropathic pain, you can almost guarantee it didn't have much of an effect.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's not that we probably know enough about it to be able to make useful suggestions and recommendations.
Yeah. And James is saying that because if you need 1,000 people to show a difference in a chronic condition, you're having a small effect.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So anything else, Mike, that you want to?
No, I think that covers it. This will come out likely as a tools for practice soon, but it'll certainly come out as part of our guideline.
Yeah.
We just wanted to give it to you a little bit ahead. Nothing is, this information is going to trickle out over time, but cannabinoids are still a popular request among our patients, and we wanted you to have the best information available.
Yeah, no, great job to you and the team, as always.
Anthony Train helped me out a lot on this one, so
yeah.
Kudos to him, too.
Yeah, no, excellent. So I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks, as always, for listening.
Talk to you later.